Information-fueled, opinion-driven. This is the Dan Mandis Show, Supertalk 99.7.
Four on Super Talk 99.7 WTN. Dan Mandis Show, 615-737-9986, 615-737-WWTN. Coming up at 1:35, a deep dive into mass transit. Yes, indeed. Going to talk to a guy. I'm really looking forward to this. His name is Rob Kramer, and he just got here from Oregon. Yeah, he's one of those people. But he's conservative, it sounds like. And boy, does he not like Mayor Megan, well, former Mayor Megan Perry's transit plan. And he's going to make some comparisons between what happened in Portland and what could happen here in the great city, in the great state of Nashville, Tennessee, if the former mayor's, now the current mayor's transit plan moves forward. So going to speak to him at 1:35 here on Super Talk 99.7 WTN. There is so much to talk about today, and I'm glad to have you along for the ride. So, yes, indeed, they are talking about some sort of a possible bloodbath within the Trump administration. Spoke about this with James Antley in the last hour. If you missed it, we may revisit that in the next hour. But they're talking about how President Trump, this is a president who may just be getting started. He could be making more changes to his cabinet this week in the wake of Secretary of State Rex Tillerson's termination. Multiple sources now telling Fox News the potential changes. And I actually kind of like some of these changes. Talking about National Security Advisor H.R. McMaster out, and his replacement would be John Bolton, who I really like, of course, a former U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, always liked him. We also know that the departure of McMaster, Fox News is reporting by multiple sources, is imminent. They say that John Kelly could be out. Now, here's the sad thing about that is I really like John Kelly. Now, I realize he's gotten himself in a little bit of trouble with this whole Rob Porter situation. But the big question is, with John Kelly, and by the way, this is a guy who brought order to the Trump administration. He really did. He made all kinds of policy changes. One of the things I really like about what John Kelly did was he kicked out Amarosa. I mean, that should be deserving of a lifetime gig, if it's up to me. Anyway, Kelly would be replaced as a chief of staff by Mick Mulvaney, the sources say, with Energy Secretary Rick Perry, of course, replacing David Shulkin at the VA. Talked about that yesterday. But a lot of people are trying to figure out what all this means. You know, one of the things that we've always been talking about, we have always talked about here on WTN and my show in particular, is this is a president who is beginning to understand the office of the presidency. He's beginning to learn how it is that he's supposed to run his administration and our country. So to me, if he needs to make whatever changes he needs to make, well, then he needs to do it. And he needs to be people who are going to be working with him and not against him. Got a great example. You know, with Rex Tillerson, we knew that from the very beginning with Tillerson and the president over, say, for example, North Korea, it was clear that they were not seeing eye to eye. And so the president did what he had to do, and he had to terminate Rex Tillerson. The bottom line is this. President Trump was brought into office to carry out and execute certain policies. And if he has people, and whether you like those policies or not, and there's a lot of people, frankly, that do not like those policies. But if the president is here, and he is here for the next 3 years, and he has some policies that he wants to put in place, then he needs people around him that will help him carry out said policies. Now, apparently there is more changes to come. Trump himself hinted that more changes might be on the way, saying, I believe this was on Twitter, I've gotten to know a lot of people very well over the last year. Trump also told reporters at the White House, he says, I'm really at a point where we're getting very close to having the cabinet and other things that I want. How many of us are waiting for Jeff Sessions to be terminated by Twitter? Wouldn't surprise me in the least. Now, for the record, I happen to like Jeff Sessions. The big question is, though, is he the right person for the job to work with President Trump on the things that the president wants him to do? Let's not forget that there are times when something happens in a relationship, and whether it's a friendship, a marriage, or a working relationship, there are things that happen that you simply cannot recover from. And in the case of Jeff Sessions and President Trump, well, it's all about Sessions and his decide to recuse himself from the Russian investigations. Because we know what happened after that. Robert Mueller came into play, and it turned into a whole boatload of controversy for the Trump administration and for President Trump personally. And the president, he's having a hard time getting over that, and I do understand why. So as much as you may support Jeff Sessions, and as much as I happen to like Jeff Sessions, there's some things that he's done that I don't agree with, but that's all beside the point. If the president is going to move forward with the policies that we all voted on, and the president needs to be comfortable with his cabinet, then Jeff Sessions, as much as some people like him, as much as some people like what he brings to the table, Sessions would have to go. Because ultimately, it is about President Trump and his ability to find a comfort zone with the people that's working with him. We all know that the president has used the terms beleaguered and disgraceful to describe Jeff Sessions, who only recently stood up to the president and defended his decision. Of course, Fox News reminding us to recuse himself from the inquiry into Russian influence in the 2016 presidential election. We all know about Rex Tillerson and calling President Trump a moron, reportedly, last summer after grumbling that the president had zero grasp of foreign affairs. You know what's interesting about that whole thing? We have a situation with Rex Tillerson saying that the president had no grasp of foreign affairs, yet it has been and has been the president's way of doing things that has forced Kim Jong-un to the negotiating table, not Rex Tillerson's. So it goes on and on. Trump's esteem for the cabinet has faded in recent months. You know, I think that there's a lot of people perhaps on the cabinet that the president never really wanted on his cabinet, but he just sort of, quote unquote, hired them or brought them into play because he was listening to people who maybe the president felt knew better than him. And so now that the president has a year under his belt, he's decided that one of the things that he wants to do is find people that are more likely to agree with him and, again, work with him instead of against him. And one of the people that the president very well could be replacing is the VA director, David Shulkin. Now, for me, the more that we find out about this guy, and I talked about this a bit yesterday, the VA is still riddled with problems. And so for the current beleaguered, I would say, to borrow presidential term from Jeff Sessions and how the president described Jeff Sessions, I would say that David Shulkin also is somebody who is beleaguered and disgraceful for some of the things that he's done. And so for the veterans and the VA, because as I mentioned, the VA still is absolutely riddled with waste and still riddled with problems. As a matter of fact, there's a story out here in the last couple of days that really has, I would say, Shulkin on the defensive. And again, there's a lot of things that this guy has done that I would say aren't necessarily things that would help the VA recover from the years of Barack Obama. And there is a report out, and I'll share with you all of the details here coming up in the next hour or so. But they talked about the Washington, D.C. VA facility, which was directly under the purview of David Shulkin when he was with the Obama administration. Because as I mentioned yesterday, Shulkin, the current VA director, he was a leftover from the Obama administration. And so they've done this inspection of this facility, and there was and still is millions of dollars in waste. The veterans that are there having their care at the VA there in Washington, D.C., are just absolutely not doing well at all. And so there's a lot of people that are very frustrated with Shulkin, including President Trump. And we know this. You know, it's just like what happened in California. This was last Friday or the Friday before, when we know this guy, Albert Wong. You remember this? He walked into one of these programs for veterans there in California, and he took three hostages, ended up killing the three hostages and then himself. And so people are asking, what in the world happened to Albert Wong? I mean, this is a guy who it was his dream to become a soldier. It was his dream to serve the military. And then, of course, like so many other of our military heroes, He came out of the military and he had absolutely no place to get him help, whether it was the VA facilities or private doctors across California where he lived. They talk about how he had trouble adjusting to regular life. He couldn't sleep at night and he was hypervigilant about his surroundings. I mean, Albert Wong was a guy who was in the Army for many years. He was decorated. And he thought that he had finally found a treatment program for veterans like himself of the Iraq and Afghanistan war who suffer from, of course, we all know, post-traumatic stress or traumatic brain injuries. And he thought that place was in California, the place that he ultimately ended up shooting up and killing three people. It is a horrible, horrible story. He, again, couldn't find the help that he needed from the VA. So he went to this place. It's called, was called, the Pathway Home. And unfortunately for him and for the three people that he killed, the Pathway Home wasn't enough. Neither was the help from the VA. And he had finally just, for lack of a better term, he lost it. And after an hours-long standoff, Wong and the three female workers, one of whom, by the way, was pregnant, so you can say four people in total were killed at the hands of this guy, Albert Wong. He was in the Army Reserve from 98 to 2002. It's a very familiar story to all of us. He enlisted for active duty in May of 2010 and was deployed to Afghanistan in 2011. A decorated soldier, was awarded the expert marksmanship badge, but also realized when he got out that something wasn't right. He was seeing really horrible things. How many of us have spoken to veterans over the past many years now? How many have spoken to veterans who have seen and heard everything in person and also in their minds? And that's what was happening with Wong. He was seeing really horrible things in Afghanistan, in Iraq, and then he came back and he was seeing all of these visions in his head, and it was really affecting his well-being. And so this post-traumatic stress affected his ability to adjust to everyday life. He had trouble sleeping and was, again, always wary of his surroundings. He was never the same after getting out of the military. He wasn't able to get the help that he needed, and you can tie all of this back to, yes, Barack Obama, David Shulkin, and President Bush. Because we know that a lot of the problems, for you liberals that are listening, I know the problems with the VA started with President Bush and then really became nuclearized under President Obama. And it was that president, President Obama and Congress, that threw millions of dollars at the VA but didn't fix the problems within the VA. And so as everybody is profiling and looking at the situation with Albert Wong and what went wrong in his situation, well, every single day there's another Albert Wong that is wandering around the streets of America ready to sadly do exactly what Albert Wong did because he didn't get the help from the VA that he desperately needed. And that's why David Shulkin has to go. And that's why, as I said yesterday, I would love to see Rick Perry as the next head of the VA, a guy who has been in the corner of veterans for his entire career. Perry, we all know, former Texas governor and also used to be an Air Force pilot. And I would say, most importantly, not somebody who is a part of the Obama administration, which is what Shulkin was. I would wonder if Shulkin was one of those people that inside the Beltway, insiders, Washington, D.C., these consultants and so forth said, yeah, you want to keep this guy. Albert Wong often became fixated on petty grievances, such as people owing him money or, as they say, not pulling his weight. He'd eventually confided to another person that he was angry at the Veterans Program staff after he had been dismissed from the Pathway Home. And so then he ultimately did what he had to do, and it's a horrible, horrible thing. All told, including the woman who was pregnant, four people killed, including himself, and now this program, because of a lack of funding, the Pathway Home has now had to close for a couple of reasons. Now, this is a home in California. They had amazing and I mean amazing results with veterans. 450 veterans with a range of post-traumatic stress, traumatic brain injury, and other issues. They'd been treated by the 10-year-old nonprofit, which gained early national recognition for an innovative, holistic approach to treatment that combined intensive therapy with music, art, yoga, acupuncture, and a range of other specialties. But because of the problems with funding, they went from helping 450 veterans over a range of 10 years to only six, including Albert Wong. The unique program hosted veterans who had tried and failed elsewhere in their effort to successfully transition to civilian life after war, and graduates often credited the program for saving their lives. But many participants were extremely challenging, capable of retreating into dark places as they struggled with their own life and death issues. They had funding challenges, and the program had to be shuttered in 2015, but a very small staff, including the three that were killed, they were able to reopen their doors somewhat in 2017, and they began welcoming clients again under new leadership. But now they've had to close it again because of the fact that, well, frankly, the people that work there are now dead. And so when we talk about the VA and we talk about all of the problems that the VA has had and whether or not the president should keep David Shulkin as head of the VA, to me, it is obvious that David Shulkin needs to go. And a guy like Rick Perry, he would be perfect to take over the VA because, again, there are many, many Albert Wongs that are out there just ready to do horrific things because of all of the things that they have seen in the theater of war, and the VA needs to do whatever they can to help those people. And unfortunately, right now, the current VA, under the head of David Shulkin, has not done what they need to do. It's 122 on Super Talk 99.7 WTN. .127 on Super Talk 99.7 WTN. It is the Dan Mandis Show. Oh, I've got to get this in before kids get in the car. You know, we always think that it is the fraternities that are full of pigs, but apparently, no, it's also the sororities as well. Listen to this. I mean, some of this I don't even know if I can say on the radio, but I'm going to. And the reason why I'm pointing this out is because we all know that college campuses, they are just inbred with political correctness. And their priorities, in my estimation, in my opinion, just completely screwed up. Yeah, but he screamed about white privilege and all this kind of stuff. Well, now there is a college in Pennsylvania, Lehigh University, and I hope I'm saying that right, although frankly, I don't care. They are in Pennsylvania. What I do care about is the sexual tasks that sorority girls were forced to do on a scavenger hunt. Now, the reason why this is important, and I'm going to try and do this delicately, although to be perfectly candid, I don't know if I can. But the reason why I'm pointing this to your attention is because right now, all across Middle Tennessee, you are more than likely, perhaps maybe, having a conversation with your kids and with your significant other about whether or not you should spend money sending your kids to college. The scavenger hunt that got a sorority booted from Lehigh University's Pennsylvania campus until 2020 reveals a list of activities women were instructed to partake in. Yes, indeed, including sexual activities. There were like 77. The Alpha Chi Omega sorority sisters at Lehigh University were encouraged to ski pole two boys. I'm going to let you look that up on the World Wide Web because I suddenly feel really awkward and uncomfortable talking about what exactly ski poling is to boys. I'll let you look that up for yourself. But also, I can say this. Hooking up with an Uber driver. Another task told participants to drink bong water. Now, Belle, have you ever drank bong water? I never have. Of course, I'm not one who participates much in, smoking marijuana.
Yeah, no, I never did that. I have a tendency in my personal life to try to avoid disgusting things.
Bong water. Yeah, I don't even know. Why would you? Can you get a high off of bong water?
I have no idea. I really prefer not to find out.
And yet another told the women to participate in threesomes. Now, why would you, as a college freshman, why would you even want to be involved in a sorority that wanted you to ski pole a couple of boys, hooking up with an Uber driver, participate in threesomes, and drink bong water? Again, there was, and I don't know why, but I instructed Bell to try and find all 77 of these tasks that had violated the school's code of conduct. Sadly, we can't find it. Lehigh University, though, they say, expects all students to uphold community standards and act in a manner that reflects the university's code of conduct. Also saying the scavenger hunt was reprehensible. Now, apparently, and this, we found this to be true.
I got a feeling we're getting another Revenge of the Nerds movie, and it's going to be a female reboot.
You know, it really could. I mean, look at what, you know, for the most part, the fraternities, and maybe I'm wrong on this, but haven't the fraternity stories we've been in, it's all about drinking. And it's all about just how much booze or whatever it is that you can pound down. I don't recall any kind of a, and I'm, you know, I'm probably wrong on this. I should probably not even, whatever. I'll just, usually I don't seem to recall in all the stories that I've had about this, a challenge where a guy would have to go out and in bed two women. I don't think that, because that's kind of unreasonable to ask of a pledge, I would think. It's a little easier for women to, you know, convince a guy or two, whatever. Anyway, all I'm saying is that women in this Me Too movement, apparently women can act just as pig-like as the men in college sororities. So, yeah, they're booted until 2020. And I, Bill, keep on that entire list of 77 if we can find that, because I am curious.
And to all the women that did any of those things, shame on you. And my phone number is on the station website.
Bell at 997WTN.com. Bell, glad to help you out. Anyway, 132 on Super Talk, 997WTN. It is Super Talk, 997WTN. Dan Mann, the show. Breaking news out of Florida. Good Lord. So apparently what's happened is a pedestrian bridge has collapsed at Florida International University in Miami, Florida. And several people have been killed. And it looks to me like, and Bell, you're looking at the same picture as I am. It looks like basically this is a pedestrian bridge that collapsed onto the roadway below. And the roadway below was a street. I don't know if it's a street, a highway, or what it is. But they're saying now that several people have been killed.
Three lanes both directions. So it looks like a major highway of some part that the bridge connected over from one part of the campus to the other.
And it was a pedestrian bridge, so we don't know if the people who were killed, we don't know if those people were in cars on the road below or if they were pedestrians walking on the bridge. And so we'll keep you updated on that story as it continues to develop. 137 on WTN. I want to welcome on into the radio program Rob Kramer. And Rob, you're here to talk about the mayors, whether it's you know, Mayor Barry or whoever. And we're going to talk a little bit about a transit bill that a lot of folks are going to be voting on here in the next several weeks. And so you come from Oregon, where they just did this whole big transit program there, and you were involved in that. You are an Oregon transplant, and so now you are here in Nashville. You're one of those, Rob, one of those dastardly West Coasters that have now made your way to Nashville, Tennessee.
Yeah, it seems I am. You know, I'm kind of a political refugee seeking asylum here in Tennessee, you know, from Portland, Oregon.
Yeah, I don't know if you know anything about me, but I come from Los Angeles. I'm right there with you by way of, you know, places like Colorado and so forth. And so we know that new Mayor David Brierley, he is somebody who is a supporter of Mayor Megan Barry's transit plan. We know that it's going to cost somewhere between, $4.5 to $9.5 billion. And then, of course, you start talking about the monthly or the yearly, the annual cost of maintaining the transit plan, ultimately over the long term. And you just went through this in Oregon, and you're somebody who have been involved and was involved in the fight in Oregon. And so now you find yourself here in Nashville, and here we are with one of the same debates going on. So what was your experience in Oregon as they decided to implement this transit plan there? And then really what I also want to know, and what folks need to know, is What are the similarities between the transit plan here in Nashville and the transit plan in Oregon?
Yeah, so here's the deal. Oregon, Portland, Oregon, has been going down this road for more than 30 years, starting way back in the early 1980s, when the mayor at the time decided that he didn't want to build a new freeway. He'd prefer to build the first light rail line in Portland, which was then followed up by seven other light rail lines over the course of the next 30 years. Now, this is really part of not really an attempt to make it easier for anybody to move around a region. Really, this is part of an ideology called New Urbanism, which seeks to change the way the people inside a city live, to wit, getting them not to use their automobile. And really, so what we have in front of us in Nashville now is a choice that people have about the future of Nashville. Do you want a future of Nashville where it becomes increasingly difficult to get around the region using your car? And are you willing to abandon your car and more use the planner's preferred mode of transportation, which is light rail and buses? That's what they're trying to
do. Isn't it social engineering, basically, is what they're trying to do? I mean, it just seems like they're trying to control ultimately where people live and how they get around.
That's exactly what they're doing. And you'll see it's not just in the transportation plan, but it's also in the land use planning system. Those things will work together to increase density in the region, make it more difficult to drive, increasing congestion, and getting people out of their cars. That's what they did in Portland. And I got here on October 17th, moving to Nashville, and I saw that very day the mayor's plan for light rail was announced. And I thought, oh, my God, we cannot do this here. This is destructive to the way people actually want to live. People don't choose to live in the way the planners would like them to. But this agenda will be forced down their throats unless they do something to stop it.
All right, so, Rob, let me ask you, as far as Oregon goes, what were the similarities between what they did in Oregon and what they want to do here?
It's exactly parallel, Dan. You see the plan here in Nashville of the mayor, whichever mayor it is now, for, what, nine different lines of X many miles of light rail as the centerpiece to the transit infrastructure in the region. That's exactly similar to what Portland has done over the last 30 years. And you'll also see, if you dig into the planning documents in Nashville, I'm sure you'll find the same types of a paper trail which they had in Portland, which shows they have intentionally underinvested in new road capacity while they made this investment in light rail. And the purpose there is to increase congestion so people use transit rather than drive their cars.
Yeah, well, we know that, of course, Portland is one of those cities that is very left. Is Portland one of those towns? We know that Nashville is growing thanks to left coasters like you. Not totally getting robbed.
That's right.
but you're conservative and so am I, so I think people are cutting us some slack. But all that being said, is Portland growing the way that Nashville is?
Yeah, it is. It is. And the planners in Portland way back in 1990 calculated that there would be a 70% population increase over the next 50 years, and their plan was to increase road capacity by 13% during that time. And their estimate of what congestion would do because of that was it would go up by 286% during that time, almost quadrupling congestion during that time. This is a written plan in Portland. So, yes, increase in population, and the planners sell light rail to people saying, hey, we have to do something about congestion. Let's build these trains. You know what? That sounds good. People kind of get duped into believing that they're actually trying to solve the problem of congestion by putting what seems logical and commonsensical, let's put some trains in so people can use that instead. But it does not reduce congestion. It adds to congestion because they have to cannibalize bus routes elsewhere, and they have to use up lane capacity on major arterials to put the light rail in. So it adds to congestion.
One of the things that a lot of folks are talking about, Rob, is the fact that when then-Mayor Barry introduced this plan, it was pitched to us as a $5.4 billion mass transit proposal. Then it magically went up to, what, it was a $9.5 billion. And now who knows what it's going to be when you talk about the annual maintenance of all of this transit as well. So I guess the question is, in Portland, did they see the cost end up going up over the years once they opened up all of this mass transit? Did it become more expensive than they originally promised the people of Oregon?
Yeah, every place that's ever been built, it always has exceeded their original cost estimates. So their cost estimates always climb. Same thing you're seeing here in Nashville. Now, the $5-something billion number was a fantasy because it didn't include the interest costs over the time that the bonds were issued. Mm. That's the $9 billion number. But I think you can say one thing with certainty, that it won't be $9 billion. It'll be 1.4, you know, it'll be 10 to 11, 12 billion by the time it's done, because the cost overruns normally are 30 to 40%. At the same time, the ridership numbers are always below what they estimate.
Yeah, and one of the things that we've seen over the past couple of years, of course, is there is a massive transit plan in Cincinnati. There was also some mass transit in Washington, D.C. Both were epic failures. So in Portland, over the last 30 years, they build a growing community. They build a mass transit just like they want to do here in Nashville. And how's the ridership?
Here's the irony of this. Since they built the first light rail train in Portland, now they have 33 miles or something of light rail in Portland. The transit share of trips around the region has actually declined. And that's an amazing thing if you think about it. After the billions of dollars they've spent building trains, the transit share of trips in the region has actually declined. Now, why would that be? It's because, first, people don't want to get out of their cars. They want to drive their kids to soccer practice or to piano lessons or to work. But secondly, because the way they try to force people on the trains is by cutting bus routes. And you'll find that same thing happen in Nashville. They'll cut bus routes in order to beef up their transit ridership numbers. But the net is that the transit share of rides around the region, or trips around the region, actually goes down when you spend $9 billion on light rail.
Rob, isn't part of the problem, too, that, you know, unlike New York and Boston and Washington, D.C. and places like that, you know, Nashville and Portland, we're not these communities, they're not built around a train. What they're trying to do, at least to me, is they're trying to fit a train system into an existing neighborhood or into an existing city. It's a lot easier when a city is built up around the train stations. In this case, in Nashville or in a place like Portland, they're trying to do it backwards, at least to me. Was that one of the problems with Portland, is that you had a city that was already existing, and then they're trying to fit this train system inside the city? That's part one of the question. And part two is, to your point, people simply don't want to get out of their cars. I mean, they just don't. Let me tell you something. If I had the ability for me to take a train, I would still rather be in my car, just because it's more convenient. Because if I take the train, I've talked about this before on the air, if I took the train into work, into downtown Nashville, well, I would still have to walk at least 20 minutes to get to my office. I think that's also part of the problem.
And it's absolutely true, and most people are exactly like you, Dan. And the hidden secret is that these trains don't move very fast, and because that last mile, the trip from the train station to your office or from your home to the train station, takes an awful lot of time and usually requires a car and parking and everything else, the total time of the trip is way more than it is in a car, even if there is some type of traffic congestion. But your first point is actually a very, very key one, and that absolutely happened in Portland. That is, any city built before 1900, before the automobile, was generally dense and built around some kind of elevated train or even a subway train like you see in some of the East Coast cities. But once the cities that grew after the automobile, everything on the West Coast and even the ones in the middle of the country for the most part that are built around automobile transportation, retrofitting a train system into that makes absolutely no sense, because the density doesn't come anywhere near to justify having a train system as a primary mode of transportation. And that's why the planners seek to increase density in the urban area in order to support their transportation system, which is exactly backwards. The transportation system should support how people not want to live, not forcing people to live in a dense area just so their trains are now make some kind of sense. And you see that happening in Nashville with the horizontal property regime. They're putting more and more houses on less and less land all over the region.
Well, the other thing, and I'll wrap it up with this, Rob, is I saw a study, and it showed that people would rather take, say, for example, Uber or Lyft, multiple people in one car, ride-sharing services to work, carpooling, whatever it is you want to call it, as opposed to getting on a train. Have you? And that was even true in places like Boston, where the city grew up, the city was built essentially around a train system. So do you see the the solutions to our transit problems here in Nashville and elsewhere as a number of things. I think that, one, telecommuting will take care of a lot of these kinds of situations as technology continues to grow, but also Uber and Lyft and some of these other ride-sharing services, that's also going to do a lot to alleviate some of these problems.
Yeah, absolutely true. And just think how backwards this is. Trains are a 19th century technology. We have a 21st century transportation problem now, and 21st century technology is going to solve it. And as you say, Uber and Lyft are easy ways, ride sharing, but think about when those ride sharing trips can be taken in a driverless vehicle. Just a driverless vehicle, but a vehicle that is able to nest itself next to the vehicles on the road and effectively increase the capacity of the freeway system by a factor of 50% or more. That's the technology of the 21st century is going to solve quite a bit of our transportation problems. And ironically, that's all going to kick in right about the time that our 19th century plan here in Nashville is fully built out in 10 years. It's crazy.
It is crazy. And it is very much appreciated that you spent some time with us, Rob, and you have a great afternoon. 151 on Super Talk 99.7 WTN. So just keep you up on the very latest. Several fatalities now in this bridge collapse at this college in Miami. It is Florida International University. And we were talking about this earlier. This is breaking news. This is sort of a walkway, a pedestrian walkway that seemingly has just collapsed onto the roadway below. And so they're saying that there are, again, several fatalities. I don't know if the people on the ground are the ones that were killed or if it was people in cars and so forth. But they are saying that there are cars that are trapped underneath this collapsed bridge again at this college in Miami. So we'll keep you updated with that story and a whole lot more right here on Super Talk 99.7 WTN.